This is video 3, Permission to Eat. And this may be one of the most challenging parts for our clients with intuitive eating. And this is based on principle number 3, which is making peace with food. So cravings run rampant as soon as we're restricted from any kind of substance. But let's talk about deprivation setup. And we've already talked about biological restriction, deprivation in the previous module or the previous video, but we can't underestimate that psychological effect of deprivation, because when you rigidly limit the amount of food you are allowed to eat, it usually sets you up to crave larger quantities of that very food later. Because depriving yourself of something you want can actually heighten your desire for that very item, regardless of what it is. It doesn't have to be food. The minute you say, I can't have that, that's when we are starting the setup of just wanting it and craving it even more. Deprivation is a biologically and psychologically powerful experience. But when diet dictates a particular food is forbidden, it just sets us up to crave it even more. And those cravings can take on a life of their own the longer that the deprivation occurs. Again, going back to the radish and cookie study from module 1, we only have so much reserve and mental space and ability to deal with our cravings and deal with that deprivation. We only have so much ability to do it for so long. And deprivation can lead to backlash. So the mere thought of deprivation can trigger overeating. Just the thought, okay, I'm going to go on this diet tomorrow, the Last Supper mentality. I'm going to restrict these foods tomorrow. I'm never going to have sugar again. I'm going to follow a paleo diet or vegan diet because I want to lose weight. I'm tired of what I'm doing, so I'm going to try this new plan. But the mere thought can set us up for that pre-diet ritual of just consuming all the foods that we're never, ever going to eat ever again in our entire lives when we do it. And even if a diet or a restrictive plan has the ability for like a cheat day, and I really, really hate the idea of a cheat day. It's okay to have food. I just hate saying like on this one particular day, you can have what you want. It's just more rules for people to follow. And if they're just having a bad day, but it's not their cheat day, then they're just kind of left to themselves. And that's usually when it's like, well, I just cheated 2 days ago, but I had a really bad day, so I'm going to cheat again. So it's not a healthy way of looking at food if you have to cheat on something. Cheat is a very negative word. You cheat on tests, like that's not a positive thing. You cheat on a relationship, also not a positive thing. You cheat on your taxes, definitely not a good thing. So the word cheat just sets up so much negative connotation. But this pre-diet ritual, this ritual of saying like, I'm going to have all the foods that I can never have again. Again, that Last Supper mentality, it really can just set us up for, you know, future disappointment. And then there's the post-diet quotation ritual. So before we start restricting, we'll eat all those foods that we can't have. And then for however long the restriction lasts, once the restriction's over, and maybe it's a planned restriction, again, the 10-day detox, or, you know, I'm going to do this particular plan until I lose 10 pounds, and then I will figure something else out. Once the restriction has been lifted, there's this post-diet ritual of, okay, now I can have these foods that I've never been able to have. And I see a lot of people promoting the whole 30 diet. So for 30 days, you clear out your diet and you can only have these certain foods. I think you're cutting out sugar and alcohol, and I'm not sure everything that you're cutting out. I think grains, at least wheat and gluten, I'm not sure. But it's like at the end of this 30 days, I can't wait to eat fill in the blank, whatever it is. And it really is that post-diet ritual of for the last 30 days, I reset my body, but I am going to have myself this one particular food when I'm done. And that can lead to a binge type of eating. And then that post-diet ritual, it just confirms our belief that we need to restrict, because we've restricted, We've allowed the restriction to lift post-dieting. Either it's a restriction that's been lifted based on the plan, or we just got to the point where we couldn't restrict anymore. And then we binge and we consume more of this food because we just couldn't help ourselves. And that just confirms, like, okay, well, I do need a restriction, because when I'm not restricted, I would just over consume and overeat on this particular food. It's just proof. We've just proven to ourselves that what we thought was correct. So if deprivation backlash and the psychology of restriction showing how it's only able to happen for a certain amount of time, how is dieting and restriction even possible? If these forces are so powerful, the biological forces, the psychological forces, then how do we even restrict at all? The people who chronically do this, they learn to adapt by changing both their mindset and their responsiveness to their inner body cues. And this adaptation is known as restrained eating. Unfortunately, again, you can only adapt for so long, and ultimately that deprivation backlash is still going to prevail. So restrained eating. Restrained eaters, in effect, are preoccupied with restriction and weight control. It's constantly on their mind to stay in control. And to do that, they set up many rules versus listening to their body, telling them when to eat, what to eat. It's a very rigid structure, and they're constantly thinking about what is going to happen next and planning ahead for any possible pitfall. And the rules work until they don't work, and they stop working when they no longer have the mental and physical ability to continue to be so restrained. And here's what happens. The moment a forbidden food is eaten, overeating takes place. So they don't have that healthy relationship with food to where they can just have a small cookie, they can have a donut, and it's not the end of the world. Once they start, it's very difficult to stop. The moment a calorie level is exceeded, overeating takes place. Even the mere perception of breaking a food rule or eating a forbidden food may trigger overeating. They don't even have to do it to get started. They may just thinking, oh, they just start thinking about it, and that thought just gets stronger and stronger, thus leading to overeating. So let's talk a little bit about the science of restrained eating. So there's a few studies. And the first is the counter-regulation effect. And this was done at Northwestern University. Those who were part of the study just thought they were there to taste test some milkshakes. But the reality of the study is that they were looking at to see if they could determine how diet thinking might affect eating after drinking milkshakes. So they split the participants into two groups, those that they identified as being non-dieters or having a non-diet mindset, and those who had a diet mindset or who were currently dieting or who would be identified as dieters. And they gave them milkshakes, and then afterwards they gave them ice cream. So the result, the non-dieters naturally regulated their eating. If they had had milkshakes, they ate less ice cream in proportion to the amount of milkshakes consumed. So if they were given two milkshakes to taste test that were in larger quantities, they ate less ice cream after the fact. Whereas the dieters ate more in relation to the amount of milkshakes consumed. So the more milkshake they had, the more ice cream they also ate. So the conclusion is that once the thought is that they'd blown their diet, that they weren't doing what they were supposed to do, it just caused them to completely release their food inhibitions. And with those inhibitions just out the window, their restraint was eliminated, and that caused the overeating. Another similar study looked at how perception affects eating. And the test was how dieters perceive calories. So people who were identified as having a dieting mindset or who were on a diet currently. So in the study, they were divided up into two groups. One group was given a high calorie pudding, one was given a low calorie pudding. within each of these groups, half of the subjects were told that the pudding was high in calories and the other half were told that it was low. So they kind of mixed it up. But what they found was the dieters who thought the pudding was high in calories ate more than the dieters who thought the pudding was low in calories by 61%. So the conclusion was thinking like, I'm on this diet, but I'm given the chance to eat this high calorie pudding. I am going to consume more. And it didn't matter about taste. It didn't matter about the perception. It's like, is this really high calorie pudding? Because it kind of tastes like some low calorie pudding. They didn't even consider that. They were told that it was high calorie and therefore they were consuming more whether or not the pudding was high or low calorie. Let's talk about the seesaw syndrome. When someone who is chronically restricting their intake or a certain food or food group, there is the seesaw effect between deprivation and guilt. So let's look at these fancy visuals I have for you. So when deprivation is high, guilt is very low. It's like, okay, I'm not eating these foods I'm not supposed to. I don't have any guilt, but there are high feelings of deprivation. And then maybe we give in a little bit. Maybe we consume, you know, just a little bit of something that we're not supposed to have. And so our guilt rises a little bit, but our deprivation is kind of at a very steady state. So the seesaw is coming back down. But then as the deprivation lowers and our guilt increases a little bit, guilt begets more guilt. And then that guilt leads to maybe eating more of that food that we have deprived ourselves of. And then we are on opposite ends of the seesaw. So then our guilt is high, but our deprivation is low. But unfortunately, the seesaw is a cycle. It's going to continue to go up and down. As we deprive ourselves, we feel less guilty. But as that deprivation starts to set in and we can't really continue on that path and we have that forbidden food or we stop the restriction, then the guilt goes up. So one of our goals is to get our patient just off the seesaw. You can't stop a seesaw. You just have to get off of it to get it to stop going up and down. So that is one of our big goals, is to stop the seesaw syndrome. And the key to that is unconditional permission to eat. And that unconditional permission to eat allows the patient to throw out that preconceived notion that certain foods are good or certain foods are bad, and we're going to help them do that. And a part of that is allowing them to eat what they really want. So yes, what they really want, which can be very scary. And eating so without making deals. Because in the past, if they said, I can eat what I want, but I have to run an extra mile, I have to diet tomorrow, I have to restrict this food for the rest of the week. But we're giving them choice back. There's no hidden agenda. There's no restriction. And that eliminates that urgency to overeat. I better eat this now because I'm never going to get it again. But this can be an unsettling prospect for our clients, right? Just to think like, oh gosh, I get to eat whatever I want, especially if they've been in a place where they've been restricting or thinking about restricting for quite some time. Making peace with food means allowing all foods back into the game. A common misconception with this approach is that it's a food free-for-all. But the point of intuitive eating is to figure out what your body truly wants, what makes your body feel really good. And this is part of that process, is experimenting and figuring out what that is. But in order to do that, you have to let foods back into the game in order to make peace. And it's that subtle shift in thinking. It's not that you can just eat unlimited hamburgers and fries. It's also paying attention while you eat. Are you hungry? How do you feel after you eat certain foods? It's about paying attention to the whole body that really makes this piece of the process very, very important. So the peace process. Intensity diminishes once restriction is lifted. So it can feel kind of ironical for people. They go, okay, I'm restricting and I can have what I want. I'm just going to lose control. But that intensity diminishes if you're just given permission. It's like if you're in a room and it's like, don't touch the red button, and all you want to do is just touch the red button just to see what happens. But it's like if you just walk in a room and there's a red button just on a wall and it doesn't say not to touch, like you probably don't even notice it or think about it. So it's like once the restriction is lifted, that intensity to break the rules, that intensity to do what you're told not to do, it just kind of diminishes, which is nice. And we're allowing our patients to instill the belief that they have control via this experience, because they don't think that they have control when it comes to food, and the peace process reinstills that belief. But clients must face official permission, and it's a fear that holds them back. They're terrified to eat what they want. They're thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to gain a lot of weight. I'm going to be worse off than when I started this process. Or if I eat too much, it's going to make me fat, or I can't control myself. But ultimately, food loses its power when you can have what you want of it. But in spite of overwhelming evidence that restriction leads to deprivation backlash, many clients will be overly anxious when they get to this principle. Just be aware, there may be baby steps into this principle because they're like, I don't know how I feel about this. But the more they practice it, the more power and control they're going to see that they have. But there are roadblocks to the peace process. And the first one is pseudo-permission. And this is going back to that idea of a cheat day. They were like, I was allowed to break the rules. I was allowed to have a cheat day. But that ability just to make peace with food and allow all foods in, it wasn't unconditional. A cheat day is very conditional. It's saying you can have a certain food or a certain meal or even a day where you eat everything, but it's only one day a week. It's just part of the rule. So it's not unconditional permission, which kind of takes away the power of unconditional permission to eat if there's conditions on it, right? Also, there's the self-fulfilling prophecy. If someone doesn't trust themselves and they don't believe in the process, they go in expecting to fail. They go in expecting the process to not work for them. And guess what's going to happen? They're going to fulfill that prophecy because that's what they believe is going to happen. So just remind them of this idea. It's like you have to go in with a very open mind, a clean slate, and just see how the process works. If you go in thinking like, this isn't going to work for me, it's not going to work for you. And just that lack of self-trust. They've lost it along the way just from many times at jumping into a restrictive cycle, jumping into a diet, and then not being able to maintain. They may still be in that mindset of like, okay, I just don't think this is going to work for me, again, self-fulfilling prophecy, but they're doing it because they don't think they can trust themselves. So it's letting them know that they're going to have to work to rebuild that trust, but that definitely can be a roadblock to the peace process. Let's wrap this video up with the 5 steps to making peace with food. And these can be baby steps. We don't have to overwhelm our patients with saying that you can eat anything that you want, because that thought is a little bit overwhelming. So you can have them pick a single forbidden food and just tell them to try it out and see if they can maintain that control, knowing that that food will always be available. It's not going to be taken away. You're not going to pull the rug out from underneath them. This isn't all a trick saying like, oh, I'm going to teach you to have a healthy relationship with food, but at the end, I'm going to say no more cookies for you. That's not how this process works. But they may think that. They may be waiting for like the other, you know, the other side of the coin for this process. So it's okay not to have all of the foods around at once. Like having those foods available doesn't mean they have to be in your pantry. Maybe that just means that you know where to get them. You can go out to a restaurant. You can buy one of those foods that you've really been restricting that you do crave and just see how it works for you. So baby steps, baby steps, baby steps for this. Step one with making peace with food is pay attention to the foods that seem appealing and make a list. Now, this is an all-encompassing list. This doesn't just mean a list of foods that they have restricted. This could be foods that they were allowed to eat and also enjoyed. Things that just sound good, foods that they like, foods that are appealing. And this can just be every food that sounds good. And then go through that list and say, what foods do I eat? And then what foods do I restrict? And you can just have a check mark by one and a circle of the other. Now, go through that list to look for a restricted food and then start with that food. You can have your patient go to the grocery store or go out to eat and then have access to that food, knowing that it's not the last time they're going to eat it. And then while they're eating it, have them check in. Does this food taste as good as imagined? Sometimes a food just seems more delicious because you can't have it. And we just build it up in our minds, but maybe it's just not as good as we thought that it was. And then make sure that there is continual availability of that food. Maybe you keep it around in your pantry. Maybe you just know if you want it again, you can go back to the restaurant and get it. So those are the steps to make peace with food. And you can do this one at a time with different foods that are on the restriction list. And even as they go through that list, maybe there's foods that they put on the restriction list that they're like, I really think this food sounds appealing. But they're also in the mindset, they're just getting out of the restriction mindset. So maybe there's foods on the list that they don't even really like that well. They're just go, you know what sounds really good? This food that I don't even like that well. And as they go through this process, they may say like, I don't even really like donuts, but I put it on the list because I know it's something I couldn't have. So some foods may naturally just fall off the list. But with this process, we are always circling back to our hunger and our satiety cues. We are not eliminating those. We are not ignoring those. So we're not just giving unconditional permission to eat in abundance. We're saying taste test it. Check it out, but also do it while you're hungry and pay attention to when you are full. And up next is video 4, food anthropology. And I love this video. I love this concept of the non-judgmental approach to observing what we are eating, what we're putting in our body.